Union. Under the Soviet diagnostic system, Soviet dissenters were classified as suffering from a serious mental illness, particularly schizophrenia. The dissenters fell into five main diagnostic groups: advocates of human rights and democratization, nationalists, would-be emigrants, religious believers, and citizens inconvenient to the state. Bloch noted, "They shared the characteristic that they had deviated in some way from social norms and conventions laid down and regarded as obligatory by the Soviet state," end quote. Because the dissidents' actions of dissension to the Soviet Union alone were considered evidence of their mental illness, psychiatrists were empowered to commit them to psychiatric hospitals for periods of weeks to years. While in the hospitals, dissidents were subjected to psychotherapy and behavior modification treatments, as well as occasional forced administration of psychiatric medications to treat their illness. Evidence of effective psychiatric treatment and, consequently, the condition of release was a dissenter's recantation of his or her dissident beliefs. We find in Soviet psychiatry a poignant example of how psychological theories are particularly susceptible to the influence of cultural norms, mores, and ideals. We find in psychoanalytic theory no less of an influence. Sigmund Freud unknowingly, or apparently unknowingly, took his late 19th century cultural norms and beliefs and translated them into what he considered universal norms of development and mental health. His thinly veiled contempt for religion, combined with his unquestioning reliance on his own Judeo-Christian culture for the definition of normal, led Freud to transform what religion considered sin into what he and his followers considered arrest of normal psychosexual development, or regression to more infantile, polymorphous, perverse sexuality. Consequently, psychoanalytic theory added very little to the understanding of homosexuality, since it shares its roots in the same Judeo-Christian tradition which condemns homosexuality as immoral. In 1973, the Board of Trustees of the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from the APA's list of mental disorders. The sizable literature which led to the deletion of homosexuality from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, the DSM, demonstrated that, contrary to traditional cultural and psychoanalytic beliefs, 1, batteries of psychological testing could not distinguish homosexuals from heterosexuals, i.e., there is no psychological profile or constellation of psychological or cognitive deficits or defects which set homosexuals apart from heterosexuals. 2, the incidence of mental illness among homosexuals is no different than the incidence of mental illness among heterosexuals. 3, there is as much psychological diversity among homosexuals as among heterosexuals. And 4, the difficulties with social adjustment that some lesbians and gay men experience mirror the difficulties observed in other socially devalued groups, such as racial and ethnic minorities and women. The declassification of homosexuality as a mental illness left us with a century's psychoanalytic writings describing a condition which existed primarily in the minds of those who provided the treatment meant to eradicate it. Take, for instance, the theory on the development of male homosexuality propounded by Charles Socarides, a psychoanalyst and leading a figure in the social opposition of lesbian and gay rights. He believes that male homosexuality results from an early disturbance in the infant's relationship with his mother. The infant perceives of his mother a hostile, withholding breast. Socarides believes that his adult homosexual male patients are attempting to recapture in their partner's penises the hostile, rejecting breast of their infancy. His penis-breast theory, like much of psychoanalytic theory, is not based on prospective, direct observation of pre-homosexual children, nor collaboration with his patients' mothers, but rather on his own beliefs about the necessary pathology and severe pathology of homosexual orientation. Such is the legacy of psychoanalysis. But as previously noted, intemperance toward gay men and lesbians did not originate with psychoanalysts. They simply codified the prejudice that already existed in 19th century Western European Judeo-Christian society into sets of psychological formulations. The fact that the actual lives of lesbians and gay men differed substantially from psychoanalysts and society's beliefs about gay men and lesbians had little impact on the propagation of the mythology of the homosexual. The dogged persistence of erroneous observations in the face of overwhelming contradictory evidence led Judith Lorber to state, "We see what we believe." I borrowed Lorber's phrase, "We see what we believe," for the title of this paper, because an examination of the perspective on homosexuality supported and proffered by LDS church leaders and LDS social services demonstrates that official beliefs regarding the immoral condition of homosexuals precedes and informs their treatment/mistreatment by ecclesiastical leaders as well as believing mental health professionals. LDS church leaders tell LDS mental health professionals what to believe about gay men and lesbians, and some LDS mental health professionals put the religious beliefs into psychological jargon, which is then quoted by leaders in support of their official positions. Ronald Bingham, the department chair of the Educational Psychology Department at BYU, and Ronald Potts, a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at BYU, approvingly noted, quote, "Most church leaders seem to agree that professional counselors can play an important role in helping individuals experiencing problems with homosexuality. However, since not all therapists in the community possess personal values consistent with gospel principles or with the church's position regarding homosexuality, ecclesiastical leaders will likely be selective in making referrals. The church has supported efforts of the LDS social services and other consulting professionals to research the issues and to offer a reparative therapy approach which assumes that homosexual behavior can be changed. Therapists who acquire appropriate preparation can counsel individuals who struggle with homosexual problems and can serve as a useful resource to such people and ecclesiastical leaders." End quote. Rather than asking its mental health professionals to review the literature and tell them if homosexual orientation can be changed through psychotherapy, the church told LDS Social Services what the conclusions of their research will be and left it up to the professionals to find a way to include the church's position in a psychological theory and treatment approach. The response from the professionals has been tail-tucking compliance. Consequently, prominent LDS mental health professionals, including a number of professors and administrators in the psychology department of Brigham Young University, are encouraging LDS mental health professionals to adopt personal and professional attitudes consistent with the church's position regarding homosexuality, regardless of professional training, ethics guidelines, and experience that would otherwise encourage professionals to remove such biases from their clinical and research of scientific and professional integrity. LDS Social Services has been replaced with religious propaganda. What the former Soviet Union psychiatrist did to Soviet dissenters in the name of the state is being encouraged and enacted by influential mental health professionals in the LDS Church at the demand and with the blessing of LDS Church leadership. Now, the heterosexualization of lesbians and gay men. One must ask, what is it about lesbians and gay men that would lead the presumably otherwise intelligent and honest men in church leadership and LDS social services leadership to self-delusion at best, dishonesty and deception at worst? The answer, surprisingly enough, is that the discourse on gay men and lesbians isn't about gay men and lesbians at all, but rather about heterosexuals. In their minds, they have heterosexualized lesbians and gay men, seeing them and treating them as if they were bad or deviant heterosexuals. Instead of demonstrating understanding of the real lives of lesbians and gay men, what we hear, read, and see from church leadership, as well as LDS social services, are beliefs widely held among intolerant heterosexuals about gay men and lesbians, based on stereotypes of lesbians and gay men, which go on to justify discrimination and sometimes violence. In the time remaining, I will briefly outline four very interdependent factors associated with the church's heterosexualized assumptions, which may account for much of the church's official antipathy toward gay men and lesbians. First, the assumption of universal heterosexual orientation. In the assumption of universal heterosexual orientation, we find the most poignant example of the statement, "We see what we believe." This assumption pervades all of the discourse on gay men and lesbians. Many intolerant heterosexuals assume that gay men and lesbians choose their sexual orientation. According to this belief, lesbians and gay men are defiant, confused, or deceived, i.e., recruited, heterosexuals. Consequently, gay men and lesbians have been punished legally, socially, and ecclesiastically for defiance, or subjected to indoctrination and coercion for the supposedly confused or deceived. Many gay men and lesbians have been counseled by bishops and stake presidents to get married to a person of the opposite sex in the mistaken belief that once a gay man has sex with a woman or a lesbian has sex with a man, his or her true heterosexual orientation will emerge. More recently, some church leaders have acknowledged that gay men and lesbians do not choose their sexual orientation, but still hold out the possibility of change to a heterosexual orientation, despite the lack of any convincing evidence that such a change has ever really occurred. From a heterosexual point of view, homosexual relationships are unnatural because, understandably, they would feel unnatural for heterosexual men and women if they were to so engage. However, church leaders give no evidence of understanding that heterosexual relationships feel just as unnatural for lesbians and gay men. When the myth of universal heterosexuality fails, those who feel compelled to condemn homosexuals invariably fall back on the authority of biblical tradition. Dallin Oaks stated, quote, "The church does not recognize homosexual marriages because there is no scriptural warrant for homosexual marriages," end quote. However, if one is to rely on the Bible to justify prejudice, it is important to understand what the Bible actually says and what it does not say about homosexuality. Such an examination reveals that biblical writers labored under the same mistaken assumption of universal heterosexuality. After reviewing the biblical passages, which are interpreted by many Christians as prohibitions against homosexual relations, Peter Gomes concluded, quote, "The biblical writers never contemplated a form of homosexuality in which loving, monogamous and faithful persons sought to live out the implications of the gospel with as much fidelity to it as any heterosexual believer. All they knew of homosexuality was prostitution, pederasty, lasciviousness, and exploitation. These vices, as we know, are not unknown among heterosexuals, and to define contemporary homosexuals only in these terms is a cultural slander of the highest order. Reflecting not so much prejudice, which it surely does, but what the Roman Catholic Church calls invincible ignorance, which all of the Christian piety and charity in the world can do little to conceal. The problem, of course, is not the Bible, it is the Christians who read it," end quote. The second heterosexualizing factor is the fusion of human sexual intercourse with reproductive imperatives. The Judeo-Christian creation myth specifies that Adam and Eve were commanded to multiply and replenish the earth. Church leaders place an extraordinary emphasis on men and women in the 20th century fulfilling the commandment given to Eve and Adam. It is true that gay and lesbian sex is not reproductive sex, but neither is the vast majority of heterosexual sex. Lesbian and gay couples use sexual intercourse for the same purposes as heterosexual couples, a way of giving and receiving pleasure, and as a way to strengthen intimate bonds. A double standard is employed in this regard. Homosexual couples are condemned because they cannot, between the two of them, procreate. But heterosexual couples may decide not to procreate or may not be able to procreate, yet they continue in full church fellowship. Church leaders further condemn lesbian and gay couples for having sexual intercourse out of wedlock, yet they pay extraordinary sums of tithing money in lawyers' fees to keep gay and lesbian couples from joining in legal and lawful marriages. This is more than feigned piety. This is sheer mean-spiritedness. The third heterosexualizing factor projected onto gay men and lesbians is the social division of men from women. Oakes' anti-gay doctrinal treatise begins with the statement, quote, "God created us, male and female. What we call gender was an essential characteristic of our existence prior to our birth," end quote. The First Presidency's proclamation added that, quote, "Gender is an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose," end quote. What they are saying is that men and women are, by design, intrinsically and eternally different. So what are those differences, and why are they being employed by church leaders as reasons to condemn lesbians and gay men? First, the differences. Social psychology research has provided us an image of what our culture considers masculine and feminine. Masculine traits are assumed to be more or less inherent and exclusive to men, while feminine traits are inherent to women. Our social stereotype of a man describes him as a leader, strong, independent, aggressive, competitive, physical, less emotional, more sexually driven, etc. Our socially constructed feminine stereotype describes a woman as subordinate, emotional, dependent, delicate, submissive, passive, creative, more relationship-oriented, nurturing, and sexually passive, to name but a few. These stereotyped gender attributes are not merely descriptive, they are proscriptive and prescriptive. Most girls and boys in our culture are socialized from birth to play with gender-defined toys, to dress in gender-defined clothes, to prefer or avoid gender-defined colors, to pursue gender-defined academic or vocational careers. Big boys don't cry, girls don't spit. Boys who prefer art to sports are sissies. Girls who prefer auto mechanics to homemaking are tomboys. Gender differences of themselves are insufficient to explain the enforced social division of women from men that we find in the LDS Church and other segments of our society. More explanatory is the way that our stereotypes of masculinity and femininity bias the distribution of power to men. Compare, for instance, the rhetoric on gender differences we hear from the pulpit to a few of the comments made by U.S. Supreme Court Justice Bradley in 1873 regarding the appeal of Myra Bradwell, who had been denied a license to practice law by the Illinois Supreme Court based solely on the fact that she was a woman. I quote, "The civil law, as well as nature herself, has always recognized a wide difference in the respective spheres and destinies of man and woman. Man is, or should be, woman's protector and defender. The natural and proper timidity and delicacy, which belongs to the female sex, evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. The harmony not to say identity, of interests and views which belong or should belong to the family institution is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband. So firmly fixed was this sentiment in the founders of the common law that it became a maxim of that system of jurisprudence that a woman had no legal existence separate from her husband, who was regarded as her head and representative in the social state. A married woman is incapable without her husband's consent of making contracts which shall be binding on her or him. The paramount destiny and mission of woman are to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This is the law of the Creator. In view of the peculiar characteristics, destiny, and mission of woman, it is within the province of the legislature to ordain what offices, positions, and callings shall be filled and discharged by men, and shall receive the benefit of those energies and responsibilities and that decision and firmness which are presumed to predominate in the sterner sex. End quote. As we find in LDS church leadership, at the time of this Supreme Court decision, all persons of power, such as legislators and judges, were, by definition and design, men. All authoritative discourse about the inherent capacities and roles of women with regards to power in the family and society was pronounced by men who jealously guarded their control of women. This 1873 ruling upheld traditional Judeo-Christian gender roles, reaffirming the power of men and the subordinate status of women, whose legal and social standing until relatively recently has been that of property of their husbands. As Alfred Lord Tennyson put it, women were, quote, something better than his dog, a little dearer than his horse, end quote. From its restoration, the LDS Church has been obsessed with the masculinized traits and attributes of power and authority. Indeed, the male-possessed priesthood has been defined as the power and authority of a male god. For church members, the possession of a penis is the first and foremost requirement in sharing with God his priesthood and his power, exercised on the most basic and intimate level over one's wife and children. The most visible symbol representing the power of the worldwide church organization is the distinctly phallic church office building pointing erect toward God. As LDS, we live in and perpetuate a culture which deifies man, while, if considering her at all, places women distinctly and definitively beneath him. This leads us to the second part of the question. Why do church leaders refer to gender differences when they attack lesbians and gay men? Simply put, they believe gay men possess characteristics which belong to women, and lesbians possess characteristics which belong to men. From a heterosexual point of view, this may make sense, since the belief of universal heterosexuality leads one to assume that, by definition, all men are attracted to women, and all women are attracted to men. McWhorter points out, the majority of gay men and lesbian women do not exhibit excessive effeminate or masculine behavior. Yet there is a frequent association in the scientific literature between effeminacy in gay men and between masculinity in lesbian women. When a man experiences sexual desire for another man, it is assumed that he must have some female characteristics to explain his female desires, and vice versa for lesbian women. In fact, despite the popular myth, you can always spot one, the majority of homosexual persons present no identifiable evidence of their sexual orientation by their gender role appearance, mannerisms, or language, end quote. Though the majority of lesbians and gay men do not manifest gender nonconformity, the stereotype feminine gay man and the masculine lesbian persist in our culture. Those stereotypes influence how we see people from those stereotyped groups. Wiesbach and Zagan presented a short video interview of a man to two groups of subjects. One of the groups of subjects was told that the interviewee, or that the man, was gay. The subjects found that the interviewee weaker, more feminine, more emotional, more submissive, and more conventional when he was labeled gay than when he was not. In a circular, self-fulfilling manner, people will see in others what they expect to see, thus confirming in their own minds the validity of their stereotyped beliefs. Again, we see what we believe. Because they are believed to possess characteristics of women, gay men are either encouraged to become masculine and thus join their brothers in their rightful place, or are treated as inferior and subordinate, like misbehaving women. Because lesbians are believed to possess characteristics of men, they arouse in intolerant heterosexual men and women the drive to put them in their subordinate and dependent place, sometimes at the threat of violence. The social division of women from men is especially important in the LDS Church, where gender determines who gets social and ecclesiastical power. But social gender role factors alone do not adequately account for the depth of intolerance engendered in many men and women in our society. The final factor of this paper takes us from the social sphere of anti-gay lesbian bias to the more intimate psychological sphere. The fourth heterosexualizing factor influencing biases against lesbians and gay men is gender enmity, particularly men's enmity toward things feminine. Heterosexual men persecute gay men and lesbians in large part because they see, or believe they see, in gay men characteristics of women and in lesbians characteristics of men. Often beginning in junior high school, children and teenagers from intolerant social climates learn to use labels such as queer, faggot, sissy, fairy, to express antagonism toward more stereotypically feminine boys, regardless of their actual sexual orientation. A man doesn't have to be gay to be called gay. When men have sex with men in cultures such as Latin America, Islamic countries, prisons, and the armed forces, only the receptive partner, equivalent to a sexually passive woman in a heterosexual intercourse, is labeled and derided by the community as gay. Male recruits to the armed forces routinely are called ladies and girls by their drill instructors until they complete basic training, at which point, having extricated all womanly weakness from their bodies and minds, they become men and gentlemen. Studies demonstrated that when sharing information about themselves and getting acquainted setting, heterosexual men who are more intolerant of gay men and lesbians describe themselves as lower in femininity and higher in agency, that is, assertive and independent, than men who are more tolerant. Internal gender enmity leads men who are intolerant toward lesbians and gay men to go to excessive lengths to make sure that others know that they are not feminine. Because of their physical similarity to boys, higher degrees of gender role nonconformity are tolerated in young girls, i.e., tomboys. But the tolerance stops in adolescence when young women developing secondary sexual characteristics are socialized to become the object of sexual conquest among men. In our culture, they start wearing makeup. Some develop eating disorders in a distorted effort to have the perfect body, while many adolescent girls consider plastic surgery to correct any perceived physical defects which might make them unattractive to young men. A woman who wears no makeup, who takes engineering or auto mechanics courses rather than homemaking, who does not orient her life around men, is at high risk of being called a lesbian, regardless of her sexual orientation. Traditional heterosexual gender enmity within the LDS Church is heatedly defended. Two prominent examples of justification for natural gender enmity are found in psychology and the Judeo-Christian creation myth. In conclusion, let's briefly explore these two sources. In its convoluted account of the development of male homosexuality, the LDS Social Services document titled Understanding and Helping Individuals with Homosexual Problems, which I'll refer to as the LDSSS document, attributes to the developing gay man a missing sense of masculinity caused by the failure of the father to exercise his, and I quote, absolute veto power over a prolonged mother-son attachment, end quote. It reduces male homosexual orientation to a sexualized drive to internalize the father's masculinity. However, none of the heterosexual males who dreamed up these theories reduce heterosexual male orientation to a sexualized drive to internalize the mother's femininity. To the contrary, traditional psychoanalytic theories developed primarily by heterosexual men turn the family into a battleground between sons and fathers, where the mother, and consequently or subsequently womankind, is the victor's prize. The chief characteristic of masculinity, supposedly transferred from father to son, is competition among men, particularly for the possession of women. In a similar vein, the LDSSS document attributes the development of lesbian sexual orientation to a mother who, because of her pathologic relationship with men, transfers her dependency needs from her husband onto her daughter, thus masculinizing her daughter. From a heterosexual male point of view, this may make sense, since women, by heterosexual male definition, are dependent on men. The LDSSS document characterizes lesbian relationships as overly dependent, though a woman's dependence on a man is seen as normal. It is the lesbian's lack of dependence on a man, or phrased another way, her perceived independence from men, which is seen as the pathologic element in lesbian sexual orientation development. In neither is there any convincing data to support the claims made by these theories. Since they make sense to heterosexuals, especially heterosexual men, they are assumed to be true. Supporting data is superfluous. We simply decide to see what we believe. The most widely employed justification of gender enmity in the LDS Church, however, is found in the Judeo-Christian creation myth. God created Adam first, and from Adam God created Eve. After Eve partook of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and gave the fruit to Adam, God said to her, quote, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee, end quote. These are the roles assigned by God to Eve and presumably all women. She is defined in terms of her subordinate relationship to her husband, for whom she was created as a helpmeet for him. We find this same ideology echoed in current proclamations by the brethren. Quote, by divine design, fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness, and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and the protection of their families. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. Period. End quote. The only task given by God to Eve and women is the only task which Adam and men cannot take from women, the bearing of children. Or can't they? Speaking at a priesthood commemoration fireside, Boyd K. Packer said of gay men, quote, never can two of the same gender fulfill the commandment to multiply and replenish the earth. No two men, or any number added to them, no matter how much priesthood they may think they possess, can do it. Only a woman can bestow upon man that supernal title of father, end quote. But isn't that what the Judeo-Christian myth tells us, two priesthood-bearing men, Elohim and Jehovah, created man, Adam. And from Adam, a man, came the birth of Eve, a woman. Our creation myth leads us to believe that we human beings are the products of a womanless creation. Our God, the ideal man, appropriated from women that one characteristic of womanhood which men cannot otherwise possess. As Lopez Corvo described in his book, God is a Woman, our creation myth projects upon God man's covetous and envious attitude toward women's unique ability to bring life into the world. A woman's reproductive potential, when possessed by a man, completes his transformation into his all-powerful ideal, God. The problem is that the rest of a woman comes packaged with her reproductive abilities. Consequently, men in power, i.e., apostles and prophets, legislators, husbands and fathers, referring authoritatively to their creation myth, have made rules, laws, commandments, and customs which carefully regulate the scope of a woman's personhood so as to complete man rather than compete with him. Ergo, the feminine ideal trait of passivity. A woman's regulated and independent personhood, which may deprive man of his ideal personal completeness, drives his gender enmity. Because of deeply ingrained gender enmity, lesbians as well as women feminists, perceived as independent of men, become targets of those men who feel entitled to possess and control women. Because of gender enmity, gay men are perceived as breaking ranks with men, trying to possess another man, i.e., feminize a man, or worse, be possessed by a man. Conclusion. In psychiatric training, I began treating a woman with a severe personality disorder. I experienced intense frustration with her because every time we made progress in the therapy, she would decompensate and hurt herself. After about a year of repeating this cycle, I experienced a flash of insight that has remained with me since. I realized that I had no idea how she thought or felt. We spoke the same language, and that led me to believe that we shared other perceptions as well, but I discovered after many frustrating hours that we thought in very different ways. In order to help her, I first had to learn from her how she perceived and interpreted the world around her. I learned from her and subsequent patients, as well as friends and acquaintances, an important lesson which I believe has improved me as a psychiatrist and hopefully as a person. I remind myself daily and teach my residents this adage by Emerson, quote, "The sign of the true scholar is that in every man there is something wherein I may learn of him, in that I am his pupil," end quote. This is the major problem with the perspective on homosexual orientation passed on by some of the LDS church leaders and LDS social services. It is clear that the writings of many church leaders, including the First Presidency's document, Understanding and Helping Those Who Have Homosexual Problems, Suggestions for Ecclesiastical Leaders, as well as the LDSSS document, do not lead to an understanding of lesbians and gay men at all. What we find in those documents are dry, dehumanizing pontifications added to caricatures and stereotypes of lesbians and gay men drawn from a distinctly heterosexual male point of view. I have 5 pieces of unsolicited, but as I see it, sorely needed advice to offer church leaders as well as my mental health professional colleagues in LDS social services. And though I anticipate that none of you are would be this audience, I invite you to share with me in these advices, or these this advice. Number one, stop talking about gay men and lesbians as if you knew them. Your writings prove you wrong and reflect badly on the integrity of the church. 2. Seek first to love people rather than judge them. Your careless and thoughtless blanket condemnations of lesbians and gay men, combined with the falsehoods you use to justify your judgments, hurt everyone in the church, especially faithful gay men, lesbians, and their families. Joseph Smith never said anything about lesbians and gay men, but he did say this of men in leadership positions, quote, "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of nearly all men. As soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." End quote. 3. No matter how much you may beg, plead, pray, or cajole, you cannot make gay men and lesbians heterosexual. But you can help them to be whole by loving them and finding ways to help them love themselves. Far too many of our lesbian and gay youths kill themselves because of what you say to them. Don't teach them to hate themselves. Encourage them to form healthy, loving, fulfilling, non-exploitive relationships with their companions or potential companions, as you do with your heterosexual youth. 4, don't hold out a promise of change in the name of Jesus. Your prejudicial beliefs are your own. By basing a change in sexual orientation on the atonement and repentance, you drive many spiritually sensitive women and men out of the church and possibly into spiritual chaos. Because they cannot change, they may feel that, due to some intrinsic evil, Jesus has abandoned them. Those who believe your false promises and remain celibate in the hopes of eventual cure are consigned to a misery paralleling that of thirsty Tantalus, whose punishment from the gods was to stand in a pool of water which forever receded just out of his reach. 5. Before you can overcome your negative biases toward lesbians and gay men, you need to be aware of your condescending and rejecting views regarding women and femininity. It is an insult of the highest order to consider all of the cultural, scientific, social, political, and economic accomplishments of women as secondary to their reproductive capacities. Likewise, it is insulting for men who have primary responsibility for raising children to consider their contributions as inferior to women's or unmasculine. Additionally, neither women nor any of their parts should be considered property, possession, or missing pieces of men. Most of what has been said and written about gay men and lesbians by church leaders tells us more about the leaders themselves than lesbians and gay men. If one wants to learn about gay men and lesbians, she or he would be well advised to set the ensign aside and invite a lesbian, gay man, or a gay couple to your home and talk to them. Rather than seeing in lesbians and gay men what you have been led to believe, talk to them, see them, hear them, love them, and believe what you see of them and their experiences. You will understand so much more. Thank you. Looks like we have about 5 minutes. Is that right? Okay. Comments, questions? Yes.
For some of these differences.
Do you want to summarize the question?
Sure. The question is about gender differences and gender role differences and whether there may, in fact, be a biologic component to that, differences. Certainly there are some differences in men and women, physiologic differences as well as physical differences. There, There are some problems, though, with the studies by LaVey, in particular, using autopsy specimens of gay men who have already died, who most of them probably had AIDS. So there is.
I agree. Well, most of them.
Yeah.
These are all socially constructed, categorical statements.
Yeah. I wasn't referring to physical differences as socially constructed as much as what the roles are. The research they did these roles are also developed by a number of the social psychology studies which talked about the roles or the differences I should say between men and women. They found these differences that I said here, but what they didn't say, and the problem with their research, is that they used the same culture. They drew their research subjects from the same culture and from the same, even the same socioeconomic category within the same culture. And then they did surveys to find out what their beliefs are about men and women. And so I'm in this way, I'm talking social construction. They did come up with these differences, but what they did not mention, and there is an intriguing reanalysis of this data, which shows that there was as much diversity within the group of women and within the group of men as there was between the two groups. So it was again one of those artificial projections. We know there's a difference, therefore we will find it. And they found these things, but they didn't account for the wide variety within the group of women and the wide variety which in the group of men, which essentially made the data unusable.
Well, I don't think you're going to be able to determine what, if there are differences by, you know, what people's beliefs are about them. You pretty much have to go looking at cross-cultural, you know, we have several
yes.
cultures have been studied and see, well, what's the difference, what things don't persist. And you have to look across species. You have to say, well, you know, let's look at primates, let's look at mm-hmm. mammals. You know, and for instance, aggressiveness, I think almost all mammals, the males, you know, a bull and a cow are bull is much more aggressive. When you give testosterone to a female rat, it will start becoming aggressive and mount mounting behavior. So there are physiological differences that contribute to the, say, where there's a bell curve for each, but the bell curves may not have the same mode.
Yeah. In primate males, testosterone does contribute to a larger build, stronger, physically stronger. But there are plenty of communities where women are the rulers and men are the drones, where the physical strength is not captured in the idea of control or power. Yeah, and so that's what we're doing is we're superimposing roles upon physiologic differences. And yes, there are physiologic differences, but the meaning of those differences is particularly what our culture is projecting onto it. I'm sorry, how to summarize. About the question was about the brutish practices of or abuses of psychiatry in other cultures and how and also abuses of power, political power to hurt people. In other cultures, and how that can you help me out with that? Speak up.
Yeah. Are there cases of involuntary use of the tools of the psychiatric profession by LDS social services?
I would say yes on one specific account, and yes on a more ideologic account. The specific account is that there are plenty of cases of parents involuntarily committing their children to psychiatric services when their child tells them, I'm gay or I'm lesbian. And because children are the under the legal custody of parents, they can be involuntarily committed. And yes, that does happen. There are plenty of examples of that happening, mostly in Salt Lake in particular. In other areas that there isn't that strong component, and I imagine this probably happens in other areas where there's a strong anti-homosexual bent or fervor. On the other side of things, there is a willingness of LDS social services providers, even if they're not willing to commit people against their will to psychiatric treatment, they are still willing to treat homosexuals as ill. So when an ecclesiastical, this is where I see the LDS social services as being the strong arm of the church. When the church convinces people that they are sick because of their sexual orientation, they send them, and the people may actually believe that, they send them to LDS social services, who use the authority of the profession to confirm that they are indeed sick and that they do need to change and that they can indeed change. And that is that's the other side of things. It would seem voluntary on the surface, but it is coercion at its finest, and abuse of ecclesiastical, and very much an abuse of psychiatric and psychology ethics guidelines. Yes.
My understanding is that any open homosexual who is not celibate is automatically excommunicated from the church. Is that accurate, or does the church, do some church officials turn in blind eye, or what is the church doing?
I know.
Homosexual Tuesday.
It really depends on the local level. The policy is that if you are having sexual relations outside of marriage, which is the official policy, you are subject to discipline. But there are some local leaders who do not force that. They may from their own experience.
Don't type thing,
I'm sorry?
Is it don't ask, don't tell type thing?
I think in some situations that I've heard of, it's don't ask, don't tell, and when they tell anyway, it's, well, okay, you've told me, but I don't really believe it, or I'm not going to do anything right now, kind of thing. So some people really try to be more humane and not force it. Any other questions, comments?
All right,
thank you very much.